Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
I'm Ed Mannion, as usual, trying to stay out of trouble as your host, and alongside me I have two of the finest sports writers in London / England / Europe / the world. To my left, Miguel Delaney, chief football writer of The Independent. Hello.
Hello.
And a second podcast appearance, as I remember it, possibly third podcast appearance.
It's at least three.
For the Wall Street Journal's Joshua Robinson. Hello.
Thanks for having me. Hello.
The first one was France versus Argentina in Kazan in Russia.
I believe that was done in a parking lot.
That was after one of the great games. One of the greatest games I've ever seen as a neutral.
The greatest for my money.
Sweating profusely in the Tatarstan sun. And then the second one, I guess, would have been the Super Classico that wasn't.
Yes, that's right.
And today, you're here to discuss Man United Tottenham, your new book, The Club, and a load of other things. But let's get started, as we said, with Wembley, where you both were yesterday. That's correct.
Yeah.
Manchester United beat Tottenham, Miguel. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is the new messiah.
Yeah.
What do you really take away from yesterday? What do you think was the big thing that you walk away from that game and you're like, I didn't know this before, but I know this now?
Well, Solskjaer managed the game well, and I think it was basically the first fixture where they kind of needed some kind of game plan, because what's happened so far, they've had a lot of easy games, and also it's been the natural reaction of very good players who are finally released from the kind of neurotic paranoia of the previous manager. So it's been actually hard to say how much of an impact Solskjaer has.
I really enjoy the fact that we still don't say his name.
Yeah.
The previous manager.
The previous manager, yeah. The Portuguese man. But yesterday there was an identifiable plan, and I think it was executed quite well to an extent. But ultimately, the game still came down to David De Gea. Like, Spurs, it could really have been 3 or 4-1.
Spurs were good, but you know, I guess the whole thing. There are several points where the game could have changed. The offside goal in the first half, injuries to Sissoko, and Kane, but I felt that Spurs maybe, like, this was there for them, and if they had won it, then it would be, you know, obviously a huge statement kind of for the Pochettino, United, Solskjaer stuff. But it just would have kind of cemented them as a team that actually has a bit more substance about them. And again, like, this United team knocking them off at Wembley is a bit of a setback for Spurs.
Absolutely. And you could see kind of the moment where they lost belief. It was about 20 minutes from the end, after one of the multitude of incredible De Gea saves. You could look around and just know they're not going to score today. De Gea is going to continue doing this. There wasn't a new idea coming out of Spurs at that point. And I don't think Pochettino had the options on his bench either.
You've probably both seen more United than me this season, but I don't think De Gea's had it's probably been his worst season since his first season in England. Is that right? Is that fair?
Maybe. And there was a little bit of a hangover from the World Cup, where he had a few issues. Where he also made a lot of...
Well, he still has issues at international level.
Like, yeah, yeah.
In Spain, they are far from convinced by him.
Well, actually, just while we were coming up to the show, someone from Spain texted me, and he read the piece this morning. And says, no one in Spain thinks that De Gea is the best in the world.
No, they don't. They were calling for him to be dropped after the first game of the World Cup.
Yeah. Right, and they're watching Jan Oblak every week.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. And it's not just that. Like, they, in Spain particularly, like, they take against the goalkeeper very quickly. And I think they would literally just rather have Casillas back, because there's such a clamour for him. He's got so many friends in the media. But even Kepa, I think Kepa was the one they were calling for during the World Cup. And you're looking at it and it's like, okay, it's not been his best season. But that yesterday was a match-defining, match-winning, match-saving performance from a goalkeeper, which I can't remember him putting in one of those early on this season. No?
Absolutely. And it's we kind of forgot that he was capable of that during the World Cup. I seem to remember that he actually conceded more goals than he made saves in Russia. and he was unrecognizable. And yesterday was kind of the reminder of, look at this guy who's not just an incredible goalkeeper. He makes it really fun to watch as well, because of his style as well. You know, I've often said that he's kind of, he's kind of the ultimate five-a-side keeper because of how he gets around on his line, how he makes saves with his feet. I saw a stat this morning that he leads the league in percentage of saves with his feet. It's about 14%.
But that speaks to basically he gets in the right positions and gets a body part.
Yeah. Well, it was also, I mean, in that sense, for the first time in a while, actually, it was actually United 2017-18 performance in the sense that they got the result mainly because he pulled off ridiculous saves. I remember just reading some stat last season. Well, basically all the numbers suggested that United would have been way off second and way off the points that they got had it not been for De Gea. He basically did inflate Mourinho's second season. And one of the reasons I ultimately cost Mourinho the job because that stopped happening this season. So this was a return to form in that regard. But there's been a bit of a debate out of it, I suppose, prompted by Solskjaer almost, who talked about the best goalkeeper in the world, the best goalkeeper in Manchester United's history. But one of the kind of strands of that, I mean, Josh is a goalkeeper, actually, always plays in our media five-a-sides, or six-a-sides, if you will, in Nets. But there is this debate about whether De Gea can be considered one of the best in the world, given the type of goalkeeper he is. Now, he's almost now, it's become got to the point a little bit with the whole Ederson and Alisson thing, where he's dismissed as just the shot stopper and couldn't maybe play in more modern, sophisticated teams because he doesn't have the footwork. Where do you stand on that?
It's an interesting question because you're right. We are sort of in the midst of this discussion about are Alisson and Ederson the kind of future of the whole position that you know, there are teams even experimenting with having keepers come out and slot in between the two center backs. I mean, it's, you know, De Gea is really kind of a throwback in that way because he is a fantastic shot stopper. But, you know, and that is his main job. We had this conversation maybe a year ago about Lloris as well, you know, before he started making a string of mistakes. But he's a guy who was seen as a kind of a dinosaur as well in between the sticks because he wasn't as proactive and he clearly wasn't as comfortable. But with United, that's not a team that wants their keeper to play out with the ball at his feet. They haven't invited that from him, and frankly, I don't see a reason why they should.
Yeah.
When you look at this game, I think you've got to look at Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, the weirdly on loan manager from Molde. And this is, I mean, after... Like
Molde is Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
The whole thing's bizarre, isn't it? But after five wins against, you know...
Six of our competitions, though.
Huddersfield and those sorts of teams. This is his first significant win. This is his first really tough opponent. What do you make of him as a coach? Like, what do we think so far? So, like, my thing yesterday is, and the piece I've written for lunchtime today is about the style of football, and essentially the fact that he kind of changed from. I mean, it's not difficult to change from Mourinho's style, which is pretty old-fashioned now, the reactive, kind of deep, staid, kind of sterile attack that they had before. And then, you know, what he's trying to do is he's trying to attack with speed, he's trying to attack on the counter, which is kind of a very Ferguson thing. You know, if you look at all the great United goals kind of through the 90s and mid-2000s, it's sweeping counter-attacks, whether that's the Giggs, Beckham, Scholes era, or if that's the Ronaldo, Nani, Tevez era. And then you saw that yesterday, they had more what Opta qualifies fast breaks than they'd had in, I can't remember what the stat was, the first 17 games of the season under Mourinho combined. Which is quite telling, and they score the goal. They win the goal back, the ball back high up the field, and within 8 seconds, I think Johnny wrote in his piece, they've scored.
Yeah,
they got speed with Rashford, they got speed with Martial, they got speed with Lingard. Lukaku didn't have his best game, I think it's fair to say, but with those guys there, it's kind of a more modern, like Fergie counter attack approach. In that, you know, Fergie's team would sit deep and then spring on the counter, whereas they were pressing high, you know, that's how they won the ball, that's how they scored the goal. But do we think that, you know, this is, obviously this result, as we said, is fortunate. Spurs could have scored three or four.
Yeah.
Do you think that this style is something that's going to prove successful for Solskjaer?
Even allowing for Spurs playing so well second half and De Gea basically preventing what could have been a bad beating, I think there is already transparent evidence, particularly from the first half, that maybe Solskjaer is much more of a much better hands-on coach than people were willing to give him credit for. Now, there's a danger. Things could level out. It could go wrong. But maybe just because of the Cardiff job as much as anything and the way he came into it and even his demeanour, in fact, he's so delighted to be in the job. There's a sense to kind of... It's a little bit too easy to write him off as a bit of a joke figure when he's clearly not. There's clearly much more there.
a lot of people around United and the players spoke of the level of tactical work they did while they were in Dubai in the last week, that it was much, and it was actually said, and I don't think this is completely down to just willing to have a go at the last manager now he's gone, but it was much more intricate than some of Mourinho stuff. And maybe there's actually more a wider question here over whether at this point it's harder to manage a club like Cardiff who are in that situation than it is to manage a kind of a super club who are reinforced by so many players in that way. And to be fair, Ferguson did warn Solskjaer at the time not to take that job because he didn't think it could go any other way. So I think already...
Sounds like a piece you should write this week.
Yes. but yeah, I think there's no matter how it ends, I think there's maybe... The one thing you can say is that Solskjaer is a much better coach than people are willing to give him credit for. Also, I hear that he delegates very well. And you can actually see a bit of a... particularly in Rashford, there's a tangible improvement in his game, even the way he finishes. And I think that that's obviously something that Solskjaer has direct experience of and has used to kind of transmit that experience.
Well, the players like it. Paul Pogba said yesterday, you know, he's enjoying his football. I'm attacking, which is what I should be doing. This is what I've always been good at. He said that Solskjaer told him to get into the box and score goals like Frank Lampard. That doesn't seem like the most complex coaching talk I've ever heard, but simplicity sometimes is what you need.
Exactly, and I think we've spoken about this before, especially around Zidane. But it's the question of maybe a generational one about whether when you go into a super club like United, like Real Madrid, whether you know what the players there actually need. Do they need a sort of cerebral tactician, or do they need sometimes an ex-player who gets it, who knows what it's like to play for a club of that size, and just give them what they need in terms of even enthusiasm, encouragement? I'm curious to hear what you think about this.
The question as well with Solskjaer, right, is you see this impact now, but if you think that he hasn't necessarily got much substance behind him, it's when they, if they hire him permanently and then in 18 months' time they're going for a tough patch, does he have any substance to it?
Yeah, that's what, and also maybe it's the way he responds to when it inevitably happens, there's kind of two or three bad results in a row this season, and that's when you see maybe a little bit more metal, because then it's about figuring out what next, which actually was one of the major problems Mourinho ended up having, that he only ever had one response to bad spells, which he'd never experienced really before 2015, and that was just to be as drastic as possible, and just ended up kind of further eroding the team. And maybe it just comes back to the point about being an ex-player in that way, and it's just that maybe it's a subconscious thing with players. Well, sorry, not just an ex-player, but an ex-champion. And in the moment, didn't Dominic have? He gave you an interesting quote before about the effect of Zidane in that regard.
But yeah, that's right. When I spoke to him about Zidane, he was like, you know, it's not anything he necessarily does, but he carries this aura about him, and the players know about what he's been through. They know that he's been a winner, and for guys who grew up in, you know, in the 90s now, that's the generation we're talking about, often that carries more weight. And, you know, there's a lot going with that as well. You know, they're making more money than ever before. They were probably, you know, more informed fans growing up than was ever possible before. And that, you know, it takes someone to also understand the culture of being a player.
Also in that, there was when towards the end of Mourinho, actually throughout Mourinho's time, it was kind of tedious debate about how good the United squad was, mainly because he was kind of playing them all down. He was playing them down all the time. But I think that was a self-serving argument, because ultimately, and this comes back to what you're getting to, a club like United, because of the wages, because of potential resources, that is such a high-level squad that there is an element of getting them to a point where no matter who you put out, if they're allowed to kind of express themselves or play in a certain structure, it will be good. It mightn't be title-winning, but it should be enough to get them to a certain level. And after that, it takes a few tweaks.
Well, should is the big word with Manchester United,
essentially. Yeah.
You know, financially, they have enough money to buy, to make a Paul Pogba signing, like a £90 million signing, more than everyone else every season. That's the financial disparity.
Yeah, exactly. There was one thing yesterday that stood out for me, actually, in terms of Solskjaer and effect, where he spoke about Rashford's finish and how he expected him to go to the near post, but he went for the more difficult quality going for the far post. And it's something he has kind of hands-on worked at Rashford. And it did remind of kind of what apparently Ferguson was brilliant at, and you have to imagine Solskjaer's picked this up directly, was not just the macro management and the kind of delegation and all that, but also the micromanagement. He was brilliant at little tips. Like there's a little Henning Berg's autobiography is actually very good in this. He'd always talk about Ferguson kind of taking the side.
That's it. He's stunned. One of the worst performances I've seen by any team was the Blackburn team coached by Henning Berg.
but Henning Berg was very good on if you're facing Robbie Keane or someone, Ferguson would have he'd always have that little snippet that he'd pull out from his database of mind. Right, he's a player that always goes that way, so you do this, and it would always come out in a game.
Yeah, I mean, and that's I guess the thing that you are seeing a lot of the Ferguson touches with Solskjaer. Is a discussion I was just having with our sports news editor actually. Is, you know, that there is this sort of now, like it's very obvious with Solskjaer coming. There's almost like a hankering to go back to the sort of Ferguson thing. It's like that's what has brought Man United success. Since he left, they've tried three different managers. You know, a Scottish guy, a Dutch guy, and a Portuguese guy. All three of them kind of different styles, different personalities, and none of it's worked. And you feel like this is almost more of a move to get back to the only thing they know, because for 25 years, whatever, 23 years, that's the only thing that brought them success.
Right, and that's why they were all saying yesterday, you know, we're Man United again. And I don't think it's necessarily, it's just a subconscious thing. I think it is quite explicit in many ways. You know, Solskjaer was a prodigious taker of notes under Fergie. He, you know, logged training sessions, committed all this to paper because he knew he would want to do this down the line. Yeah. And he's not the only one. There are a few of the more cerebral players do that as well. I remember Xabi Alonso telling me that he logged every training session, having played for the great managers in the game today. So it makes perfect sense for Man United. And for a club that was in need of such an emotional lift as well, it's the obvious solution.
And if we're talking about this game, are there any on-field points, Miguel, that you want to make before we move into the off-field stuff? Because this game, like, you know, the build-up to it, as you wrote, was as much about the, you know, obviously the Pochettino versus Solskjaer thing. The Man United job is expected to be up for grabs in June. The kind of transition, like Spurs are a club trying to chase down, they're trying to hunt down teams like Man United, but they've got the stadium issues and they're being held back, and can they hold on to their stars? And all. There's so much off-field stuff, but on-field, is there anything else you want to say?
Well, it's all basically related to that. I mean, I think Spurs, again, despite, yes, they've been another frustrating setback and that you feel they should be making that step, I think the fact they're so high in the league is a credit to Pochettino and that team, because really, given their resources, they shouldn't be. Because this squad at the moment is being completely pushed to the limit. They don't really have a midfield. They now have an issue. The hope is Kane isn't injured.
They lost two to injury yesterday.
Yeah. Although the look on Kane's face from people that know him, they're worried, basically. And there's already talk that could be the injury that he got, or was it last season? He was there for 4 weeks. The hope is that happens. Because if it does happen, Levy has to do something he really doesn't want and properly invest this January. But already, they do need reinforcements now. And this, of course...
But they weren't planning to get any, were they?
No, but that's they did need a midfielder already, but this feeds into the wider debate, I suppose, about Spurs, and something I suppose we'll get onto with Josh's book, given it's about essentially the growth of the financial aspect of the Premier League, the Premier League as much as anything. But I mean, ultimately, like, if it's a sort of game where I could finally convince Pochettino to leave, in the sense that, all right, he has a team, he wants to go further. He needs a midfielder. He goes to Levy. Okay, well, he can have maybe the 5 million we get from Dembele potentially going to China. Whereas Manchester United think, well, here's 200 million, and we can buy you a £90 million player every summer if you want.
Yeah, and that thing with Kane is really interesting to me, because if Kane is out for any period of time, I mean, how many years has he been in the team now scoring goals?
Since 2014, he got this proper big break. Although Sherwood had given him kind of his initial breakthrough, it was the autumn of 2014 when he broke into the team properly.
So this is his fourth full season of being like the guy, right? Yeah. He's only really had one or two injuries that I can remember. He's been very reliable. And they've hugely lent on him, because they haven't had, you know, they brought in Vincent Janssen, terrible, Fernando Llorente, to be the backup to him. Because they were like, well, we've only have one striker, and if he goes down, we're in all sorts of trouble. Now, those two guys have proven that if Kane goes down, they're still in trouble. And Llorente might be able to leave for Athletic Club in Bilbao, his old club. So I expect that Kane will be okay. I hope he'll be okay. If he's out for any length of time, given the financial realities of this new stadium and the problems that the Spurs have had, what does Daniel Levy do?
Well, as Miguel said, the thing he really doesn't want to do is spend money, but Levy's going to have to sort of hunker down and now accept that you know, this is the situation we're in. And it's much like Arsenal sort of after their stadium construction in 2006 through to about 2010. The austerity years are going to be very harsh. And it's just going to be, guys, we have to make do with what we have. And if Kane, who is plan A, B, and C, isn't available, then, you know, that might translate to a slide that they're going to have to accept.
Just before Christmas, there was an interesting moment. There was a posh press conference, and the issue of Dembele came up. And this was before. It was known he was probably going to move soon, but not definite. And this was already when the midfield issues arose. And one of the guys, I think it was Dan Kilpatrick from Standard, goes to, he asks Poch what the story is with Dembele. You know, his contract's up in the summer. Will you keep him till summer or will you sell in January? And Poch just with a chuckle goes, what do you think Daniel will do? If basically, if an offer comes in January,
he's gone. Yeah. you know, especially with the context of Christian Eriksen not having signed a new contract. So his runs out next summer, right? 2020.
Yeah.
Which means that you need to sell him in the summer of 2019.
And there's a lot of talk. Spurs are already planning for that happening. Yeah. Departure.
So they're going to need a big midfielder. If they have to go out and sign a striker of note this month, because that's what Kane's injury would necessitate. If Kane is out for any period of time, that seriously jeopardises their Champions League qualification hopes. Financially, the Champions League qualification is absolutely essential with the new stadium. Mm. Right? So, I mean, and that's before you even get into who it would be, because I haven't got a clue. I don't know what you're going to do. When Bournemouth are asking for $75 million for Callum Wilson, I don't know what Spurs would do to try and replace Harry Kane.
Especially because they can't actually buy a striker. Even if they had the money, they can't buy a direct someone as good on Kane's level, because
you need to buy a versatile forward, yeah. Like Son. So yeah. Like Son is obviously away at the Asian Cup now, right? Mm. He's after this game, he's going away, and is it they have to win for him to avoid military service?
No, that's the one in the summer.
Right, okay, so that's fine, but he's away at the Asian Cup. Who plays up front for them if
Lucas Moura is the suggestion.
Lucas Moura as a striker. Yeah. So if you bought in a good versatile attacker, someone who next season maybe would play wider as like a support player to Kane, but can fill the void for a little bit, that might make sense. But buying an out-and-out striker almost isn't an option, because you're saying to them, you're a stopgap, and then next year you're going to be the backup. And their record of buying backup strikers for Kane is abysmal.
So. Yeah, I mean, it's quite, you know, coincidental, but what they need is essentially a Solskjaer.
Yeah, no, it's not the worst. Not the worst of it. And how do you see the managerial thing now? So Solskjaer versus Pochettino. What do you expect? You know, who would you, if you were Man United? I guess it's different questions. If you were Manchester United, who would you hire in June? Who do you expect Manchester United will hire in June?
It's still, from what I heard, Pochettino's still by far their number one choice.
Plan A and plan B.
Yeah, I think they will go for him. I think they should go for him. I think he is the manager that someone they've been waiting for. I increasingly don't think it'll happen, and I think there's a chance Solskjaer could end up with the job. There's a lot of will from at the club to do well enough to get the job. But I think what it will come down to is ultimately that, first of all, Spurs themselves are confident they can keep Pochettino as much as anything, and this is what it often comes down to with Levy, because it's so legally ring fenced, it's so difficult to extract him from the club in that way. So even if Poch was trying to force his way out, that would be an issue.
Expensive.
Yeah, but I don't think Poch would force his way out. He wouldn't want to cause a problem in that way. He likes it at Spurs, and there's a lot of talk around Poch himself that his preference, when it comes right down to it, is arguably to stay, because he's built up so much in that club, he's got so much invested, he enjoys it there, and also there'd be a real sense of unfinished business. The one thing is, I suppose it's apparently he see like the potential wrinkle in that regard is that, whereas Real Madrid, he sees that basically as a job that comes up every summer. I remember there was some talk last summer where someone in Spain said to me, Florentino, and you know, when he comes calling and you say no to him, he doesn't go back. Well, that's not true.
Yeah. Well, he also, Florentino hired his seventh choice last summer.
Yeah.
So, like, the whole Real Madrid thing, you know, I think it's pretty well established among every coach in the world. Like, you know, if Jurgen Klopp wants the Real Madrid job at any point, he can go and get it. Like,
yeah,
that's not a problem.
Yeah, exactly.
If Tuchel wants it, he can go and get it. This is not a job that, one, is hard to get if you're any good, and two, rare.
Exactly.
Because the opening comes up so frequently.
Exactly. And there is maybe a sense from Pochettino's side that this could be a rare opportunity to take, if it came to take over United, a good point to kind of...
A low ebb for where they should be.
Yeah, exactly. So that could... But my inkling is that he will stay. But you know, but again, you never know. A lot can happen next week if they fail to get Champions League.
No, I think there's also the thing that you see what Poch has done at Spurs, and I get the impression, obviously, with reason, he's very proud of that. Solskjaer, for me, now has put himself in the frame to the extent that, like, I can't see them going for someone like Zidane, or, like, there's no third party, I think, who could now possibly be attracting United.
I don't know. It's Miguel hinted at it just now, but I think what Solskjaer is showing is, or reinforcing, is that the Man United job right now was kind of undervalued. That for the right manager, there are huge possibilities there because the squad is legitimate. It is, it can win, and it's, I don't know, we had kind of gotten it in our minds over the last few years with between Moyes, Van Gaal, and the third guy, that that, like, suddenly everything was toxic there. You couldn't go near it. You couldn't deal with Ed Woodward, that they were going to buy badly, and that they were in the sort of being dictated to by agents and everything else. But it's actually a situation where it looks like quite a good club to go manage now again.
And I guess that is significant because, you know, in the book you've written so much about the structure of clubs. You know, it's more about really the off-field product and the Premier League as a whole, and how these clubs became super clubs and everything. The owners, you talk to owners, you talk to managers, sporting directors, and, you know, from what you've seen, Man United has obviously become what it is. But, like, kind of, which of the interviews in here, and there are some great ones. We're talking about Randy Lerner, who I think is an interesting one because of the disaster he had with Aston Villa. But, you know, this is a guy who's been an owner in many sports. And there are so many tales of foreign owners who have come in and been stung by the Premier League. There are other ones who have come in and succeeded really well. Kind of, which was the most interesting and rewarding interview you did for this book?
I mean, Randy Lerner is certainly up there. So just to recap, the book is the story of how we got here in the Premier League, how from quite a parochial concern in 1992, when the clubs were hyper-local, they were often owned by sort of locally self-made men.
When men were men.
not that.
the era of Doug Ellis.
Exactly.
Ron Nodes.
Exactly. You sort of made your fortune locally. Maybe you owned a factory or something like that, and then you bought your boyhood club. Whereas today, it is this playground for the 1% of the 1%, who have come in from every corner of the world and see different reasons. They're not just investors in some cases. They're also, you know, burnishing their own images. They're also seeing it as trophies. You know, it's all of that, and it's how it became this. Sports and entertainment behemoth now. So with all of that, you know, the idea, the adventures of Randy Lerner in the Premier League were really fascinating to me because he came into it with the best of intentions. He didn't want to come in and, like many other American owners, kind of revolutionize the way people did business, thinking, hang on, it looks like chaos over there. What they need is some good old American know-how, and we're going to do this above board in the right way. And they're under-marketed, under everything else. He wanted to come in and be sort of a classic custodian of the club. So he came in, he made improvements to Villa Park, one of the grand old institutions of English football.
Didn't he do up the supporters' pub? That was the big thing.
Yep. He sank several million pounds into the pub. And he tells a story about running around Bloomsbury trying to get the colours for the mosaic right in the Trinity Road stand. So really, he wanted it to go well, and he was stung so hard by the reality that the Premier League is populated by there are a lot of good people in the Premier League, but there are a lot of charlatans running around as well, and people who are just in it to take your money, exploit the fact, the little gaps in your knowledge, and sell you lies. And he got caught completely unprepared for a lot of that. And one thing he says is that he was quite turned off by Martin O'Neill in the end, because O'Neill had run the Villa's transfer policy and sank a lot of money into players that he didn't think were had any resale value or anything like that.
Martin O'Neill, actually.
A lot of late 20s sort of British and Irish players.
Self-managing players, yeah.
Exactly. And that incident when O'Neill finally walked out on him turned him off completely. Lerner delegated everything to other people, and the club went into a complete freefall.
Well, I mean, just having read the book, obviously, as a narrative in where we... to explain where we are, how we are with the Premier League, it's exceptional. But one thing that really stands out for me is the amount of kind of scoops and basically unknown info that's in there. I mean, so I think it's already been discussed in Second Captains, but for me, it was the story that really stood out was the meeting between Chelsea and Dean about Thierry Henry and whether Abramovich could actually have bought Arsenal, which is kind of almost the most mind-blowing aspect. But what stands out for you in terms of when someone was telling you something and you're like, hang on, wow.
I mean, I love that story. Yeah. About the Dean meeting with Chelsea, because they'd kind of gone through the squad and they weren't able to strike a deal for anyone. And
As an insight into how business is done, that's quite interesting. That basically Chelsea and Arsenal basically going through the Arsenal squad, who can we take off you?
Yeah. Yeah. And the guy they really tried to ship to Chelsea was Francis Jeffers. And Chelsea, for perhaps obvious reasons, were not interested. And finally, they get to Thierry Henry, who theoretically was off the table at that point. And Dean insists that he never tried to sell a player that Wenger wanted to keep. But the discussion comes up, and the price keeps spiraling upwards. And finally, they get to about £50 million, bearing in mind that the world transfer record was under 60 at that time. Yeah. It was still Zidane. And Dean slams the table and says, for that kind of money, why didn't you just buy the club? And it turns out that Abramovich had been wrongly informed, according to our source, that UBS had said Arsenal wasn't for sale.
That's remarkable.
and it, you know, it makes you think how much the complexion of English football could have changed, because Abramovich had also looked at Tottenham. And we heard the story from the other person in the car with him on his way to the meeting, going up the Tottenham High Road to White Hart Lane. And Abramovich looks around out the window and turns to his guy and says, this is worse than Omsk, which was a pretty grim outpost where Sibneft had a refinery at the time.
At what point, actually, did you think... when it was really kind of not conspicuous, where the Premier League went from what we described as this kind of parochial concern, which it really was. I mean, it was a league populated by English, Scottish, Welsh, Irish, and basically Norwegian footballers. This is essentially the makeup of the division. But at what point do you think it really started to become like what it is now, which is maybe the world's true international league?
It's a good question, and it happened in stages. I think, you know, one of the first watershed moments in terms of its international growth was Abramovich. Because not only did he come in and upend the whole transfer market and upend the traditional order of English football as well, because up until that point, the Premier League had been a story of Man United and Arsenal with that one Blackburn Rovers interruption. Suddenly, Chelsea, which was a club that hadn't won the league since the 50s, is not just a contender, but a major force and a sustainable one. And, you know, with a guy who came in from abroad that they knew very little about when they sold the club to him, you know, the diligence was minimal. They Googled him, found him on a Forbes list, and didn't know much else about him at that time. So, you know, and suddenly they went shopping in all of Europe's biggest clubs, and that was a huge turning point. There was the internationalization a little bit before.
The Bosman ruling.
Yeah, the Bosman
which
ruling.
Which wasn't necessarily, it wasn't a Premier League thing, but it affected the Premier League hugely.
And the Premier League made the most hay
they
from
benefited
it. Yeah. And, you know, Wenger's arrival as well, suddenly signing, seeing that the market inefficiency was non-British players. All of that contributed. It was really a confluence of factors. But also, what made a difference in terms of growing the game abroad and that no one ever matched was kind of the genius of people like Richard Scudamore, who pushed to sell the rights abroad so forcefully and so diligently, because what they, you know, when the Premier League was first drawn up, they were actually paying foreign broadcasters to carry the games, and they didn't ever think that the international market would be such a huge thing. Mm. And instead, you've got Scudamore coming in. They take the rights back from the agencies that were selling them in bulk, and go and decide, we're going to sell them individually in each market and build all of those relationships. And that was what Scudamore did so well.
I think it's actually one of the key insights of the book, really, and one of his main conclusions, that, I mean, there's so many images of perceptions of what the Premier League is as a cabal and all the rest of it, but really, how Scudamore, particularly his own role, how he redefined it was basically just almost as a salesman for a show. And this is ultimately what it came down to, TV rights.
Exactly. The Premier League is first and foremost a TV rights-selling organization, a little bit like Formula One. And, you know, the contrast for me is clearest when you look at Scudamore versus other leaders of big global leagues. You know, you compare him to, and you'll know this, Roger Goodell at the NFL, who sees himself at, he makes $45 million a year, sees himself as the chief disciplinarian of the league, the chief ambassador of the league. Scudamore gives very few interviews. You don't see him around so much. And his main job is maintaining those relationships with broadcasters all over the world, to the point where he's even sending them handwritten notes and thanking everyone at the end of every season, not just saying, not just the people who buy the rights, but also the people who don't have them, because he says, your best friends may be the people who are future partners.
I think Scudamore is a really interesting character in all of this, because, as you say, he's kind of quiet, kind of stays behind. You think about the amount of interviews you see given by people like Javier Tebas, who's the president of La Liga and a complete clown. But Scudamore is a guy who, you know, I was talking to him at an event recently. It was a Premier League event, kind of for his last year in charge of the Premier League. And I guess, you know, his legacy might be tainted slightly by the awkward way in which he left with that £5 million payment, which was pretty unnecessary considering how much he's earned over his career. And he said to me that the key that the other leagues don't understand is that the Premier League is fundamentally a great broadcast product. Not just, you know, it's good football, entertaining football, whatever, but I remember when Palace came up was it 13-14, the Holloway season, and the club had to spend £1.5 million on upgrading the television gantries in the old Arthur Waite stand, that awful one you see opposite the press box, so that they could fit out ultra HD cameras, 3D cameras, all that sort of stuff. They didn't have the infrastructure there to hold those, and one of the Premier League regulations was that you had to have that now.
Mm-hmm.
So what they were doing was, and they had to upgrade the lights as well, the floodlights. And what they were doing was essentially making sure that the product that you see on television is as good as it can possibly be. It's bright, it's vivid. It's
the stadiums are full.
Exactly. It's colours. And you see the other leagues trying to do this via the back door and not getting it right. Like, La Liga are finding clubs when there are empty seats on television. That is not getting to the root of the problem. The root of the problem is the ticketing or the matchday experience, whatever. Premier League clubs have done great things to improve the matchday experience and all that stuff, but fundamentally, what they focused on is making it a great broadcast product to look at across the world. And you know, sometimes you look at games from abroad, and it looks like they're being filmed in the 80s. You know, it's live. Like, I find it with like Napoli in the Champions League, whatever it looks like.
Exactly.
You're so far away, and it's old, it's rubbish.
And that's kind of the key insight from going back as far as the founders of the league, people like David Dean and Martin Edwards and Irving Scholar, the guys who saw the future and had been spending a lot of time over in the States, had seen the NFL, and had this major realization that you can't necessarily just assume that the support is always going to be there. And you have to give the fans something back for what they're paying. And because they're not just supporters, they're also customers. And I realize that might sound a little bit cynical, but they realized this very early on, and suddenly it became geared to the customers. And so if you're giving them a high-quality product from the broadcast, from the match day experience, and ultimately from the football, because that caught up as well, then they will stay loyal.
But one of the traditional arguments made about the foundation of the Premier League in particular was that it was basically a kind of a greedy cash grab by a group of self-interested clubs. Now, again, whether you agree with that is almost beside the point, but you actually, in terms of their vision, more so say than what they did, you're more generous to them in the book, I think. You think it wasn't just kind of a, here's an opportunity, it was actually there was real foresight.
You know, the Premier League is really a product of the 80s, and in many ways. So, yes, it is the greed is good era, but it's also the kind of trauma of English football in the 80s as well. You know, there had been the stadium disasters. The football was bad. The stadiums themselves and the experience in general was not a pleasant one. It was, you know, you were kind of taking your life in your hands to go to a game. So there was a lot of, there was kind of a panic among owners as well to change this. And, you know, some of the connections that we were kind of surprised by, but that make perfect sense, were, for instance, the Taylor Report after Hillsborough immediately required clubs to upgrade the stadiums, switching to all-seater facilities. One of the knock-on effects was the clubs realizing, hang on, we're going to have to pay for these upgrades too. And that was a key factor in getting teams on board for the breakaway and the foundation of the Premier League. I don't think we'd kind of put two and two together before, until we were working on this book, about how all these things were interconnected.
I think, frankly, you know, we've only scratched the surface of how many pages?
340-odd
pages. This is the paperback version I'm holding in my hand. The book is called The Club, How the Premier League Became the Richest, Most Disruptive Business in Sport. You didn't write it alone, we should say. Your colleague, Jonathan Clegg,
yes,
at the Wall Street Journal, also played a huge part in that. RRP is $14.99, but we're going to give one away. Is that correct? Yeah, sure. Yeah, I've got a copy for sure. So we're giving one away, which we'll get Joshua to sign. If you leave a review for the podcast, just telling us how much you love it, basically, then one of you will get selected at random, and you get a copy of The Club, which is, as we have alluded to in the last 15 minutes, an excellent book. So thank you, Joshua, for coming in.
Thanks very much for having me.
I think we should probably cover some other football, any other business, basically, in the last, say, 3 or 4 minutes. Johnny isn't here today, if you're wondering, because, in his own words, he hasn't finished Joshua's book, and he doesn't want any spoilers. He said, I've read up to the Blackburn winning the title. Fergie is furious, but please don't spoil the ending. So Johnny's not here.
It goes well for the Premier League. Yeah. I don't want to ruin it for anyone, but it goes well.
While I've got you as well, just a reminder that you can join Independent Minds, the new subscription service from The Independent that gives you access to exclusive articles, events, ebooks, and a new app, all with no advertising, because everyone hates advertising. Subscribe today for just 15p a day. Visit independent.co.uk/podcast to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Any other business?
Spying.
Miguel, unenthused by the rest of the Premier League. The big story of the week, Thursday, Friday, emerged that while Frank Lampard was training Derby County for their huge game against Leeds on Friday night, sixth against first, and a man with pliers and binoculars was found at the perimeter fence. Police were called. The man was detained but not arrested because he wasn't actually breaking the law. It turned out this man works for Leeds United. Marcelo Bielsa has assumed all blame for this. He said that he's been doing this since he was Argentina coach in 2002. What do you make of it all? It was quite a furore. For what I basically thought was a bit of a fun story.
I thought it was mostly hilarious, to be honest. Just to go, especially as you kind of allude to, the rudimentary nature of it, just the amount of pliers. It's not, I mean, I think Josh is about to get into it. It's just not sophisticated spying at all. And the kind of the moral fulmination afterward I found ridiculous. And I mean, I did see there was a lot of journalists, obviously, who criticised it. But the one thing that hasn't been able to answer, or they haven't been able to answer, I suppose, is in what way is it different to something I would see as completely legitimate, which is what amounts to, I wouldn't say espionage, it's journalism, but amounts to kind of revealing key details from a team you cover before a match, or revealing a first 11 you found out. It's ultimately taking someone else's secrets for your own end.
I love this story because it's such small potatoes in the end. It's the idea that, you know, one guy spying on a or sort of using pliers and binoculars to have a look at, you know, half an hour of a training session before you play a match,
like set piece training or something. You know, like what are you going to gain by like seeing who runs to the near parks particularly?
Right, and you know, assume with the amount of information we have today, you know, the amount of tape that's available and the amount of analysis. I mean, how much is that really going to add? But what I enjoy is the when you compare it to spying scandals in some other sports, this is so Bush League. You know, you look at baseball, for instance, where the St. Louis Cardinals scouting database was hacked. You know, people might go to jail over this. There are criminal charges happening. You look at famously Spygate in the NFL.
Yeah.
When there were illegal recordings being made of behavior on sidelines.
Signals.
They were stealing the signals.
They were because teams that were within the division played each other twice. And so they were filming when division teams came to their stadium. They were filming what they were doing, the signals and the play calls, so that when they played them again, they knew what was going to come.
Basically. And this was the New England Patriots, and then or even.
But the punishment for that was severe, though.
Yeah, they lost the first round draft pick, which the NFL and chief disciplinarian Roger Goodell came down on them very hard. But the other thing is, you know, there are sports where any kind of, you know, stealing someone's little piece of info or a piece of technology amounts to corporate espionage, which is, you know, you look at Formula One, and when someone walks down the pit lane and steals a design for a front wing or something like that, and eventually runs it back up to the R&D department and impacts change, you know, that's Ferrari stealing from McLaren or whoever you like.
Yeah, yeah. But in football terms, these are, as you know, again, going back to the book, these are huge billion-dollar corporations now. And why wouldn't they be trying to get something over on their business rivals?
Right. And, you know, if you have $1 billion then and you're really concerned about this, then maybe buy a taller hedge.
Yeah, better fencing is the way. Miguel Delaney Fencing Co. is available if you are looking to upgrade your perimeter. Go at Miguel Delaney on Twitter, and he'll help you out.
Oh, yeah.
I'm only picking on him because he's not paying attention because he's on his phone. As I say,
researching a piece.
Yeah, researching a piece while I'm talking to you. Joshua, thank you for your time. I know you need to go, and so do I. But thank you very much for coming in. Thank you for telling us about your book. And, of course, if you're listening to this, then you probably are already interested in the Premier League. But if you want to find out how the Premier League came to be what it is right now, then this book is excellent for you. Is it available in audiobook form?
It is.
Excellent. Who's reading it? Like Stephen Fry? Like Ricky Gervais?
Well, I think you'll be reassured that it is someone with an English accent.
It's someone with an English accent, which is great for us because, you know, we're taking back control. And Miguel, thank you for coming in, as ever. Yeah. We're looking forward to your piece on everything that you've just said for the last hour.
It's the best thing about the podcast.
Yeah, it's the best thing
about
the podcast.
So much for ideas. I had no ideas coming in, and now I've got a few.
Great. And as I say, join Independent Minds, a new subscription service from The Independent that gives you access to exclusive articles, events, e-books, and a new app. All with no advertising. Subscribe today for just 15p a day. Visit independent.co.uk/podcast. And until next week, I've been Ed Mallion. Goodbye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.